You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Today is the 2nd of February, 2017, and today we're going to be talking once again to Nomi Prinz, who you will remember from our previous conversation on GRTV, where we were talking about the Federal Reserve and the brave new world that it's moving into in this era. She's, of course, at NomiPrinz.com, where you can find out about many of her books, both historical fiction and nonfiction, including, of course, All the President's Bankers, a very, very detailed history of the last century or so of relationships between presidents and bankers. And lo and behold, well, we have a story developing right now of just such a relationship. This story was originally posted to TomDispatch.com, but it's been posted all over the web. Naked Capitalism, Common Dreams, it's up on Zero Hedge under the title Nomi Prinz on the Goldmanization of President Trump, in which she goes into the ties between the Trump administration and Goldman Sachs. It is a pleasure and an honor to have you on the program again, Nomi. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so very much, James.
Well, it's great to have your input on this topic, not only because you have written one of the most exhaustive and exhaustively documented books on the relationships between presidents and bankers of the past century, but of course you have your own experience with Goldman Sachs directly. So that will obviously be informative as we proceed with this conversation. But in order to understand, I think, what's happening now, we do have to understand a little bit of the history. I think people have heard Goldman Sachs referred to as Government Sachs because of its revolving door, but how did it get to where it was? And in your book, All the President's Bankers, you note on page 202 of my edition, Goldman did not approach its zenith of influence in the scheme of alliances between key bankers and presidents until the 1980s, when the firm lobbied behind the scenes for laxer commodities trading rules, and in the 1990s and beyond, when it stretched into the heights of political financial influence in the Treasury Secretary post on both sides of the aisle through Democrat Robert Rubin and Republican Henry Paulson. Revisionist history makes it seem as if the firm was always as influential as it came to be, but really Sidney Weinberg, the former chairman, was an anomaly for decades, a true operator and connector. It wasn't until Lyndon Johnson's Treasury Secretary, Henry Fowler, who was a friend of Weinberg's, left Washington to go to Goldman Sachs that this new chain of power relationships between the firm and D.C. truly began. So tell us a little bit about that sort of pre-history, if you will, of Government Sachs, talking about the Weinberg era and how it became the firm that it is.
Yeah, well, Goldman Sachs, of course, was an investment bank before Sidney Weinberg came to take it over. And he, in the 1920s, when a lot of things called trusts, which are really the past version of what we, I think, can today call securitization vehicles or CDOs or all the sorts of names that are associated with packing a level of either loans or securities or bonds or something inside a less transparent other financial instrument. And in the 20s, those were trusts. And they basically packed into them different stocks, different bonds, different associations with private companies into sort of one vehicle or one trust. And actually, Goldman Sachs was one of the companies that was involved in creating these trusts and selling them to investors at the time. And in the 20s, of course, there was very lax regulation in general with respect to banking, but in particular with respect to, you know, new sorts of instruments like these. And so there really was no oversight. So trusts could be developed. The stock market was having, you know, an excellent time. There was money to invest. It was post-World War I, so America itself was on an upswing relative to the decimation that had just happened in Europe and that was being rebuilt in Europe. So there was money coming in from overseas and money from the country itself, and lots was going into the market. And these trusts were a way to sort of leverage that, and Goldman Sachs was one of the companies involved. However, by the time we had all that fun and got to 1929 and the crash of the stock market and the crash of these trusts, which were sort of leveraged bets on stocks and other types of ventures, a lot of companies looked really bad to investors and also in terms of their own evaluations. Weinberg was running Goldman Sachs at the time, which was one of the many companies whose trusts imploded and against whom there were potential lawsuits. There was a lot of strife. There was a lot of negative perception because people lost a lot of money. And, you know, these sort of ideas that, you know, these were crooks on Wall Street and all that sort of thing that had basically leaked, basically bled people of this money. So what Weinberg was doing was trying to find a way, and he was a very, he was a public-minded person, but he was a banker and he was an opportunist, and he had a lot of friends and business connections throughout, having created these trusts on Wall Street and so forth. And he was also getting closer and close to FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was the governor of New York at the time. This was all going down. And was running for president in 1932 when Herbert Hoover was obviously not going to be reelected president, given that the crash and the subsequent depression had happened under his watch. And FDR was rising in the Democratic Party. He was well known anyway. He had run before as a VP candidate, didn't make it, and now was his chance. And Sidney Weinberg sort of saw that opportunity to both resurrect Goldman, his own reputation, and the sort of role as a financial political operator. So he wound up helping FDR raise money for his presidential bid. And as it turned out, of course, FDR won. And he remembered his friends. He remembered, as presidents do, the people that made money for them going into running for that office. And he gave Weinberg a lot of roles as sort of a policy advisor. We call it today policy advisor, basically advisory roles. So they weren't officially appointed roles. They were just different types of business council type advisory roles, you know, the connection between the business community and the political community. And so Weinberg had that under FDR for three and a half terms. So there was a fourth, a piece of four term that FDR had been in, as well as then after FDR. So through President Truman, through Eisenhower, through JFK, through LBJ, through Nixon. And so he basically was involved behind the scenes. And that's how that happened. But the company grew in that manner, sort of with him at the forefront of that connection between Wall Street and Washington. And then the second theme of that was what happened to some extent under LBJ with Fowler, as you mentioned, but to a bigger extent into really the 90s and into Bill Clinton's administration. And that's kind of Goldman part two in terms of the history of the relationships and the influence that Goldman has had as a bank on the presidency and on domestic and foreign policy that's related to the presidency, and also regulations, deregulations, and so forth in the financial system, in the commodity system, which relates to the energy sector, and all sorts of other sectors that basically finance themselves and are active in the derivatives market.
Well, as people who read your books may or may not know, your own personal biography coincides with Goldman Sachs. Tell us about your time at the firm.
So right after Robert Rubin, actually, who was a co-CEO of Goldman Sachs and became the Treasury Secretary under Bill Clinton, having done basically what Weinberg did, which was help Clinton raise money to run for his presidency before he became president. And then he was subsequently made head of the National Economic Council, which was created by Clinton for Rubin, and then he became Treasury Secretary. Around that time, I was actually working at Bear Stearns in London in the 90s, and there was a lot of talk of deregulating the large banks in the United States to actually compete with the European banks, so to have investment banks and commercial banks connect and repeal the Glass-Steagall Act, which FDR had passed in 1933 to separate investment from commercial banking. And there was a lot of push from the investment banking community to have that be repealed, and from the commercial banking community for different reasons, and commercial banking world first, even though in general deregulation was something that both sides wanted. And I was working in Europe, as I said, at the time. I moved over to New York from London to actually work at Goldman Sachs as a managing director in their research area. So I basically ran two areas. One was the sort of quantitative credit analytics, which were part of what fueled credit derivatives, and a lot of the CDOs and other types of securities that became at the sort of vortex of the subprime crisis and beyond, as well as another area that worked with restructuring sort of corporate insurance company, financial company balance sheets in terms of restructuring loans and rejiggering them into other securities. So it's very much the same types of engineering that were at the crux of this crisis and really other crises in different capacities. So that was my stint at Goldman Sachs from 2000, which was right after Glass-Steagall was repealed and the firm actually went public as well before I got there in 99. And then I was there for a couple of years, saw what was going on, quit in 2002, so 2 years after I joined, and then wrote a bunch of books, including Other People's Money, which was my first book, which came out in 2004, and talked a lot about what it was like in those years at Goldman and that particular relationship between influencing the presidency from inside an institution and just what it was like within the institution as that was happening, and also warning of how unregulated securities and derivatives in how they were being traded and constructed and used and the lack of transparency and regulation of them would basically cause a financial crisis. And in particular, after the repeal of Glass-Steagall in 1999, which allowed first big supermarket banks to exist with commercial banking and investment banking combined so that deposits could be used as basically collateral for bets, for bigger bets and more esoteric securities. But what that also did was it caused banks like Goldman Sachs, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, which those two no longer exist. I did work at both of those as well. But caused them to push the government to allow them to leverage or to bet more on the margin against assets they did hold on their books. So in other words, to borrow more against what they had than they should have been able to do and encourage and push the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, to allow them to do this. And one of the people that pushed this was Hank Paulson, who, when I was at Goldman Sachs, was the CEO and chairman of Goldman Sachs. And then a little bit after I left, but in 2004, he was one of the key people trying to convince the SEC and regulators in Washington to allow this leverage internally for these investment banks, the ones that chose not to merge with a big commercial bank as J.P. Morgan did with Chase, but to stay alone and yet have the same sort of competitive power, the same ability to make big bets that the commercial supermarket banks now could do because they had bigger balance sheets with all these people's deposits and loans on them. And then, of course, 2 years after Hank Paulson did that, he became the Treasury Secretary for George W. Bush in the run-up to what became the financial crisis in 2007-2008, a lot of which was caused by his pushing leverage into investment banking taking advantage of that change in rule. And prior to that, Robert Rubin, having been one of the key pushers of repealing Glass-Steagall, which caused the banking sector to become these investment banks who wanted to leverage themselves more, and these commercial banks that owned investment banks who could do it naturally after the repeal in 1999 of Glass-Steagall. So the two of them had a large impact on what we know to be the financial system today. I worked at Goldman when Hank Paulson was the CEO and chairman, and after Robert Rubin had left to be a part of the Clinton administration as Treasury Secretary.
Well, I think there's a couple of different ways in which this revolving door functions, and one I think is very overt and the public understands and sees that, and one is more, if not covert, at least not as well understood because it's less difficult to see. And the one that I think is overt is, as you gesture to, for example, with Weinberg and FDR, when a banker helps to fund a politician's campaign, obviously they're going to expect certain favors in return, and I think the public understands that. So we can see, for example, Barack Obama, one of his prime top donors back in 2008 was Goldman Sachs. So people understand how that relationship functions. But the less publicized relationship is the one that I think you go into such great detail here in All the President's Bankers, talking about the not just the personal indebtedness of a given president to the banks, but the sense that the president has to find a way to work with the banks so that the financial system itself can continue to function. So there is some quid pro quo that goes on, and each president comes to his own different relationship. And for example, you could point to Teddy Roosevelt and J.P. Morgan. And Teddy Roosevelt felt that J.P. Morgan was the person who could save the economy in the crash of 1907, the panic of 1907. And so that's the kind of relationship that he tried to foster. And going forward, we can see that with every president. And as I say, every president has their own particular relationship that they come to with the bankers, sometimes closer, sometimes more distant. Now, as we enter the Trump era, I think people may be too distracted on the idea, oh, Trump doesn't need the bankers' money, therefore he's not beholden to their interests. But that's not necessarily the type of relationship that's going to be developing here. I'd like to get your thoughts on what we can tell so far about what Trump's relationship to the banking community is and what it might be as he tries to proceed with his restructuring of the American economy.
Yeah, I mean, it's very simple right now what his relationship is, because he has basically appointed a Treasury secretary who is a former partner at Goldman Sachs, and as head of his economic council, the former president of Goldman Sachs, Gary Cohn, who actually was my boss's boss when I was at Goldman Sachs. He was one of the managing partners at the time of the FIC division, fixed income, currency, and commodities. So the area that traded, the area that took risk. And through that, he ultimately moved more up the firm into the president or number two spot at Goldman Sachs. So it's very clear what Trump's current relationship is with Goldman Sachs, which is that he has the number two guy at Goldman Sachs coming in as a major policy advisor for both domestic and foreign policy, in the same slot that originally Bill Clinton created for Robert Rubin when he first came to Washington, from which Robert Rubin quickly became the Treasury Secretary. So it could be seen as the number two spot in the Treasury Department, even though it's not an official Assistant Treasury Secretary position. But that is how it worked under Clinton. So there's Gary Cohn, and there's of course Steve Mnuchin, who wasn't as high at Goldman Sachs. He was a partner. His father was a partner there. I mean, he has that history, that connection. But more importantly, he has a mentality of Goldman Sachs, because after he left, and he actually left Goldman Sachs the same year I did, which was 2002, he made a whole lot more money than I did. I became a journalist. I chose a very different path that I'm quite comfortable with. And he chose the path of becoming a hedge fund operator and other things. And in the capacity of running a hedge or private equity fund, Dune Capital, which he created a little after he left Goldman Sachs with two other former Goldman Sachs partners, he wound up creating a consortium or gathering a consortium of hedge fund runners and sort of other wealthy individuals to purchase IndyMac, which was a failed bank in Pasadena, California, not too far away from where I live now, and basically buy it on the cheap from the FDIC, who had sort of taken it over as it was failing. It was much more of a sort of community style type bank, so it was suffering from people who couldn't necessarily pay their mortgages during the subprime and mortgage crisis, but who could have had them worked out, and some did, but many didn't, and thousands that could have worked out their mortgages under the purchase of Steve Mnuchin and his team were forced out of their homes, and even in questioning in front of his hearings, for his confirmation hearings, he positioned himself as being a hero for having taken over this bank, because it would have been far worse, he said, for these people had he sort of not come to the rescue with all these sort of millionaires and billionaires in terms of their individual wealth or their firm wealth. And so therefore he was a help to them. To my knowledge, none of these people have thanked him that he says he helped. So I don't know. But I do know that many people and groups are involved in legal battles with him and with the company that he was involved in that did take over that bank and did get involved in forcing people out of their homes and used government money to fund that process as well. And those are some of the questions he was asked and sort of tried to answer in his hearing. And some of the things that he did after having left Goldman. And so the two of them, both of them represent this mentality of risk-taking that both connects into Trump. So now they are his bankers. So if I were to write another chapter, which I will probably have to do at some time in some revised version of all the president's bankers, and follow Trump as the president after Obama and his relationships with his bankers. His bankers are Steve Mnuchin and Gary Cohn. And both of them, not simply having come from Goldman, and of course, Gary had a more senior position at Goldman, and Mnuchin had probably a more lucrative position outside, although they're both incredibly wealthy and have done well from that respect. Their mentality of risk taking is not dissimilar from Trump's. Their concept of regulation or deregulation in the financial sector is not different from Trump's, not different from Rubin's. So the mentality is something that carries through, and that's what I really tried to talk about in the piece that you refer to on Goldmanizing Trump. It's really the bankers that each president connects with. And many have been from Goldman, but even from other firms, when whether they're policy advisors or appointed positions, tend to have a like-minded approach to the financial system, to the banking system, sector, to regulation, to transparency, to accumulation at the top versus distribution throughout, and that sort of thing. And so that's what these two people represent to Trump, and actually also reflect. Trump, who is a deal maker. It's interesting because this year, well, actually for the last 6 years running, Goldman Sachs has been the top M&A, merger and acquisition advisor in the world. This is now the 6th year running. So in the world, not just of finance, but the world of like the world related to finance, they are the deal maker. Gary was involved in that senior position at that firm throughout all those years. So it's that mentality that goes into DC. And in my opinion, we have problems as a global economy, as a citizens economy, when in particular the American government is creating policies that deregulate or destabilize that financial system. It doesn't have good outcomes for the rest of the economy.
Well, I think I don't give the question credence when people say, well, who would you expect him to appoint to head of the SEC or head of the Treasury or these important financial posts? It's not going to be a carpenter or a mailman or something, a dog catcher. Of course, it's going to be people within history and finance. It's going to be bankers. I think that is a bit of a trite question. But the underlying point, I think, is an apt one, which is, could this system function in any other way? Could it function to have these positions of such centralized control and power that have a huge influence on financial matters and on the industry without having some sort of relationship with the bankers themselves? And I don't myself, and you've documented a century now, at least, of this type of relationship between presidents and bankers. Could it be any other way?
Well, I mean, there's certainly an element of wanting someone running a Treasury Department to have some idea of finance and business and perhaps law, and not sort of learn on the fly. That's completely valid. And yes, I mean, a lot of people do say, well, who do you expect? Hillary Clinton ran sort of on this idea when she was asked about the speeches she gave and just things she'd said about people on Wall Street, that for regulatory positions, the people that know it should be the people in these positions. But, it's kind of like saying, and I don't know, I'm not really good at sports analogies, so you may have to help me out with this, James, but it'd be like taking, say, an outstanding athlete that has actually been proven to be using steroids or something else. I don't mean someone who's been accused, right? But I mean someone who's actually, fundamentally taken an unfair advantage, let's say, over other athletes in a particular field or whatever, and saying because that person's an athlete, then they should be the one in charge of some, if we had an athletic, secretary of sports or something in Washington, but as opposed to someone who has equal you know, time and knowledge of sports or of that, you know, area, but hasn't had that tarring. You know what I mean? So it's not necessarily so much where someone comes from. It's what they've done and what they represent and what they want to do from that position. Goldman Sachs, with Gary in the number two position, has copped to a lot of fines for a lot of crimes with the Department of Justice, the SEC, the FDIC. I mean, it's got a laundry list of violations under his watch. Steve Mnuchin has companies that have a laundry list of violations under his involvement. So it's not necessarily just whether someone comes or doesn't come from a particular company or a particular sector. It's who they are and what they've represented and what's happened in their purview.
Yes, exactly right. I mean, we don't even have to go for sports analogies. You could just think, I mean, would you appoint a convicted felon as the police commissioner or something of that sort? I mean,
right. It's that far simpler. Yeah, exactly.
But as a Canadian, let me use this opportunity to make the analogy of Ben Johnson being head of the International Doping Agency or something like that. But anyway, that's the sporting analogy you were looking for. But the point is well taken. These are people who have been involved, intimately involved, in Gary Cohn's case in the number two position, slated to be a potential successor for Blank Fine at the head of Goldman Sachs, a firm that has been involved in genuine violations that have taken place, and yet now is going to be in an extreme position of power. It really does create a sense of hopelessness in a lot of people who have seen this happen time and time and time again. And a lot of people who I think genuinely thought, well, Trump isn't beholden to the bankers, therefore it will be different, and it is more of the same, which leaves us wondering if it can ever change from within the political system. My answer would tend to be no, but I know other people are more optimistic. I don't know what to say about that.
Well, I just think that right now, being optimistic is probably less realistic than being... well, that's much pessimistic, or perhaps, but just being highly aware and highly critical of what actually happens under these people and what the ramifications could be and will be under them. I mean, I think that's really the step in terms of you know, it's not necessarily like an average citizen can kick out the Treasury Secretary per se, but it's important, as it was when Glass-Steagall was repealed, to understand the ramifications of the kind of risk that put into the financial system. And it wasn't a risk that was hard to determine. I mean, there was many people who questioned it, not enough, but there were certainly people who questioned what the ramifications could be. They were in the minority, they were shut up, whatever. But I mean, it's. I think now we have much more communication across platforms than then, you know, a lot more on social media, on things like this. I mean, where people actually can get sort of more information and form their own opinions, right or wrong, with enough information or requiring more information along the way. And I just think that vigilance will be an action in terms of watching what these people do in their positions of power.
Absolutely. Well, I am looking forward to your own vigilance on that, because I do value your take on these things. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm also looking forward to your forthcoming book, Artisans of Money, which we talked about in our previous conversation, and which I'm distracting you from the writing of. So I will let you go shortly. But perhaps we should just give a nod to that, and the fact that perhaps, I mean, if there's a ray of hope here, it may be that the actions of the Federal Reserve banking system and the banks that populate it may not be so important in the future, right?
Well, I think, Artisans of Money really looks at that line between what the Federal Reserve and what it required of other central banks did in the wake of the financial crisis, and is actually still doing in terms of cheap money, artisans of money, creating ways to basically artificially stimulate the banking system and the markets, and what again will be the ramifications of that, and how they are getting I don't know if they're getting to the end of their sort of bag of tricks. Some people have said they have been, but I mean, I've been looking through all the documents and all this stuff, and it's amazing how creative they've been very quietly throughout the process, and as well as publicly, in terms of the extent to which they've buoyed the markets, and the extent to which that's created a lot of artificial bubbles and policies and strifes between governments and central banks and strifes between people and governments, and has really laid the pavement for kind of the chaotic world that we have right now, sort of the destabilized both financial and political world that we have, and people's general disenchantment with all of that. So I kind of follow that throughout the world in this book, and we'll see what happens when it comes out.
We certainly will.
I may be writing the last few pages as it's going to press, but at this point I have to hand it in 4 weeks.
Right. Well, I will let you get back to it. I am looking forward to it. In the meantime, we'll direct people, of course, to NomiPrinz.com, link in the show notes as always, and you can check out her other books, including All the President's Bankers, which we've been talking about here, and the link to the article about Trump and Goldman will be in the show notes as well, so people can read a little bit more detail about some of these characters that are now being appointed to high positions of power in the Trump administration. Nomi Prinz, I always value your time and input. Thank you for appearing on the program.
Thank you very much.
The Federal Reserve, the heart of the American banking system. For over 100 years, it has operated in the shadows, controlling America's money supply in total secrecy.
So all that information is available in our commercial paper program.
And who got the money?
Hundreds and hundreds of banks. Any bank or that has access to the U.S. Federal Reserve's discount.
Tell us who they are.
No.
Until now.
100 years ago, in 1913, the Fed was created.
Fractional reserve banking.
The legal authority to do it.
Takeover of monetary policy.
Are conducted by the Federal Reserve banks. They are banks.
There is no other agency of government which can overrule actions that we take.
Century of Enslavement, the history of the Federal Reserve. Watch the documentary for free at corbettreport.com/Federal Reserve. And purchase a copy on DVD to help support the Corbett Report today.